Well, let's dive into the things. We've been starting this series on the Sermon on the Mount. And as we've looked at it, what we're seeing now is that Jesus is still in the introduction. And it's the longest of Jesus' messages recorded in the Bible. And we're still in the introduction. We're still looking at kind of overarching themes that undergird everything that he's about to say. We've seen in previous weeks that the main theme is the blessed life. What does it mean to live the blessed life? So he starts in the Beatitudes. Blessed is the poor in spirit. Blessed, you know, eight times, blessed. What is he saying? You know, that these are the ways of learning and discovering what it means to live the blessed life. And the blessed life, more than anything else, is summed up in the first and the last Beatitude, where it says, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Ultimately, what it means to live the blessed life is when we discover living in the context of what we're created for, that we were created for relationship with God. We're a relationship where we allow God to reign in our lives, where we discover the peace and blessings that come as we live under his rule. And so he invites us to be able to embrace and to live out this blessed life. But as we look at this blessed life, we say, okay, now what does it mean to do it? How do we live it out? Some people would take it and they'll take the idea, well, you know, this is a common theme. You know, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to church and I'm going to discover this at church, and that's one category of life. And so a lot of people will say, well, this is, you know, one part of life, and I've got this faith over here, and I go out from church, and then I go to the work, and that's a whole nother category of life. And then I got my family, and I've got my entertainment, what I do with recreation. And a lot of people have these ideas that it really doesn't mix. You know, well, here's what God's doing on Sunday, and that's different than what is happening on Monday or on Tuesday or at home. And what we have to realize is that as we look at this, this was an idea that is not new to our time. It was something that Jesus anticipated, and he speaks to very directly here in this part that we're looking at this morning. And he starts off and he said, okay, these are the keys of the blessed life. And when you do this, you're going to allow God to be center in your life. You allow him to be king. You submit to his lordship. He'll change your heart. He'll change your character. And that will become something that is evident not only in your private life or what you do on Sunday, but it will be something that is evident in every aspect of your life. And that's what we see in verses 13 through 16, where he comes back and he starts to say, now here's what it means to live this out. It means to engage in the world. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the earth. Now let's look at the first part, the salt, when he says here in verse 13, you are the salt of the earth. See, in our day, when we think of salt, we think of something that is primarily a seasoning in our food. It's very inexpensive. You know, you buy a big thing and it's, you know, very, very cheap. One of the cheapest things you'll get at the grocery store. And while many of us really value it, few of us would really call it a necessity. Now, what we have to realize is that in Jesus' day, salt was something that was very much a necessity, and it was also something that was very expensive. It was something very valuable. In fact, something that you see carry over in our English language is that it was not uncommon for people to be paid in salt. And so we have in our English language, we talk about someone's salary, which is from the root word salt, which is the idea of being paid in salt. And so it was something that was very valuable and very important. See, the value was not only in how difficult it was to produce, but it was also in how it was used. While we see it as something that is primarily a seasoning, in Jesus' day, you didn't have refrigerators or freezers. So if you slaughtered a lamb for dinner and you didn't eat all the meat, you couldn't just throw it in a freezer and save it for next week or next month. You couldn't throw it in the refrigerator. What would happen is it would go spoil very quickly. And the only way to keep meat from going immediately bad was to salt it. And so what would happen is that you would have a person that would kill that animal. They would, you know, cook what they would use for that day. And then they would take the rest of it, and he would carve up the meat, and he would rub salt into the meat until the flesh was penetrated by that salt. The salt would be dissolved in the meat, penetrated. And so then what would happen is it would become not only a seasoning, but more importantly, it was a preservative. It was the only thing that would keep that meat from going bad, that would keep it fresh. So now when Jesus is saying, you are the salt of the earth, what he's saying is something not only about us followers, but he's saying something that is vital for us to realize about our world. What he's saying is that we need to understand that the world left to itself is in a state of rot and decay. It will naturally rot and decay. You see, we understand this in the physical realm, don't we? Think about it. If you leave a building alone for 10 years, you come back and what's going to happen? go to Rolling Acres Mall and see what happens. You know, we see this building that has been left and it has been, you know, rotted and decayed. It has fallen apart. You know, we think about our bodies. You know, we go out there and we try to take good care of our bodies and we take vitamins and we exercise. But you know what? Our bodies are falling apart. You know, there are things that I can do that might delay a little bit, but the fact of the matter is there's nothing we can do to stop it. Because all of us are involved in this natural process of decay. This is something that's taught in the Bible. Look what Paul says in Romans chapter 8. For the creation was subject to fertility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. What he's saying here is the natural state of creation is that we're in bondage to corruption. The natural state is in creation, not only physically, but spiritually, is decay. 22, he continues, for we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now, and not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we await eagerly for the adoption of our sons, the redemption of our bodies. That's a reality. The fact is that sin has invaded our world and it's causing us to fall apart. God created a perfect world in the Garden of Eden, and after sin, that perfection is broken, and the natural state of our world is decay. Now, if this is an evident truth in the physical realm, then we shouldn't be surprised that it's also the natural state of the world morally and spiritually. See, that's what we see happening all around us. We look at it, and it does seem like our culture is decaying morally and spiritually at an alarming rate. And Jesus is telling us, well, don't be surprised. You know, apart from some intervention, that's what's natural. He's telling us also that we shouldn't be discouraged. Because while it is natural and inevitable apart from some divine intervention, he's also telling us that the good news is that there is some divine intervention. And so while it is natural, it is no longer inevitable. Because God has interceded into our world to reverse the decay. God has stepped into our human history, and at the cross, Jesus not only defeated sin and death, but he also defeated the effects of sin and death. So what we see happening is that when we understand the gospel and all that that means, it means that he not only forgives us of our sin, but the effects of that sin in our lives. And then as we bring the world or the gospel into our world, he begins to reverse the effects in the culture as well. Look what Paul says in Colossians. In him, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. What Paul is saying here is we need to realize Jesus came to reconcile all things to himself. He came to fix everything, to align everything back to the way it was supposed to be. Now, it's not instantaneously, but as the power of the gospel comes in, what it does is it starts to be a preservative influence of not only, you know, stopping the decay, but actually turning it back. That's what the gospel does, not only in our own lives, but as we live it out in the culture, and the culture as well. Or consider the Great Commission. Here you have in Matthew 28, as Jesus is giving the Great Commission, the great challenge to the church. Look what he starts with. Matthew 28, 18, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. In his kingdom language, he's saying, I've got all authority, not only in the kingdom of heaven, but I have all authority in the kingdom of earth. My victory at the cross not only defeated sin and death in the spiritual realm, it's defeated it in the earthly realm as well. And now that being the case, now I'm entrusting you and saying, now go and take the authority that I've given you. And what does he say? Bring the gospel because it has the power to transform. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all I've commanded you. And behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. You see, this is a passage of optimism. We can look at it and we can say, well, the natural state of the world is decay and decline, and we see that happening. And you know what? If we think about that, we can get discouraged. We can live in a pessimistic perspective. Because apart from God's intervention, there's a lot of pessimism. But the fact is that when we look at the Bible, what we find is that God calls us not to pessimism, but to optimism. To realize that God has intervened. And he doesn't call us as followers of him to just hang on and hope that we can last until the rapture comes. He calls us to now go and take the gospel, bring it into all the world, bring it into the midst of a decaying culture, with the hope and confidence that the Holy Spirit will use our faithfulness, work through us, and bring hope and bring preservative influence to literally not only stop, but to reverse that decay. That's why when Jesus says, you know, you are the salt of the earth, what he's saying here is he's saying something that is, you know, transformative. It's not just saying that God has come into our lives and changed our nature, and he has. And so that he's forgiven us our sins, and we see in our own lives those who are believers. What we've seen is that the sin that was rotting us away, that was killing us, that was destroying us, suddenly our nature has changed, and God is redeeming us, and God is bringing healing where there was brokenness. But it's not only that, but when we look at this, our purpose has changed. So we now bring the effect of that salt into the world, even to those who don't believe, because the more that we engage our culture, the more that the salt works its power. Now, you know what is, when we look at this historically, this is what has happened in the history of the church. When we look at it, yes, it's really easy to be discouraged in our time and age. Yes, it's really easy to look at our time and to see, yes, are things going bad? Are we declining morally and spiritually? Yes, we are. I'd be foolish not to admit that, to not see that. But you know what? Think about the early church. The early church, when God established the early church, it's 120 Christians, you know, up in the upper room, and he says, okay, now here, I want you to go and be my witnesses. And the environment that they were in living in the Roman Empire. They were living under, you know, totally godless rulers. The religious rulers of the day were the Jewish leaders who had just put Jesus to death because they opposed his message. So they were totally opposed to everything that Jesus stood for. But Jesus looks at him and he gives him 120 and says, okay, now I've given you my authority. Now go and be my witnesses. Go and be salt. And what happened is that they lived that out. And 120 not only shared the gospel, but as they shared the gospel, what happened is that they lived in a culture that totally, you know, had no value for babies. If you had a baby and you didn't want it, you threw it, and they literally went out and threw it in the woods for the wolves to eat. And so Christians went out and started to find these babies that were left to die and started orphanages and started saving babies. And suddenly a culture changed so that they valued human life. Or in that culture, there was violence that was in the games where people, the games in the Colosseum, they cheered and you know, got excited about people being killed by animals and wars. And suddenly what you had happen is you had Christians who started talking about truth and the value of life so that within a couple hundred years, those games were outlawed because there was a culture that had been so changed by the salt of believers in Jesus Christ that they no longer valued that. Slavery was done away with. You know, when we look at it, Rome, all of Western civilization was transformed. Not because everyone there accepted Christ. Many did, and the church spread. But because Christians lived out as salt, and they rubbed themselves into the world so that it was transformed. So now let's look at this and say, what does it mean then to live out salt and light? How do we live out this idea so that we become transformative influences? You see, God brings hope to our world as Christians, not only understand this privately, but live it out publicly. He accomplishes work of redemption but through his followers acting, first of all, as salt. Matthew 5. You know, we see, you are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. Now, I said a couple minutes ago, again, that the purpose of salt was not just seasoning. It's a secondary purpose. In that time, it was to combat decay. And in the same way, Jesus is teaching that just as the natural state of meat is to decay, so the natural state of the world is for moral and spiritual decay. And the only hope for our world is for Christians to be salt, for Christians to penetrate the world in a way that it serves to work against this decay. So now, what does this mean? And to understand this, again, we've got to understand salt a little bit more. See, and again, that day, you know, we look at it and we think of salt in our day, just table salt. And that day, salt was very expensive. It was hard to get. It was, you know, they would mine it and rock and dried beds, or people would actually go and they would take, in certain areas, they would take, work on actually, mining from underground seabeds and through evaporation and take out the salt out of salt water. And so it was something that was very expensive. But here's what they would do with it. You've got to understand, now, some of you have been here for a while, I used this illustration before, I'm going to use it again. because it says it. When you look at what salt is, my wife even says I've got to be somewhat, you know, clean here because I'm going to be do something that is, you know, that is not very. It's got a lot of germs. People are going to wonder. It's just like we're doing communion, and he's going to handle raw meat, and he's got a bit of a cold, and just to put your mind at ease, I asked Pastor Bob to help serve communion, so I'm not going to be touching anything, so you don't have to. Our germophobes don't have to worry about, you know, what I'm going to do here, but I've got some meat here. All right. Now, what happened with salt? What would happen is that they would just not, you know, just take salt and sprinkle it like we would do. What would happen is you would take salt and you would put it on, but you just didn't sprinkle it. What would happen is that they would take the meat and you rub the salt into the meat. It's something that it was a process, that it actually is something that's not just, it's not, you know, just not just, you know, just safe. And you look at this and you say, well, why are you doing this illustration? Because this is kind of gross. And you got raw meat. And it's, you know, it's like you're getting, you know, you're going to drip stuff on and you got to do, you know, communion. And so why are you doing this? Well, the whole idea is when you look at this illustration, how did salt get into meat? It was rubbed in. And you know what? Is that clean? No. It's kind of gross. It's kind of messy. You get germs. And you know what? That's the whole point. If we're to be called the salt, what we need to do is not just say, well, let me from a distance, let me just, you know, I've got some brokenness in the world and I don't want to get messy and I'll just sprinkle a little bit. No, we got to pick it up. We've got to say, no, I've got to pick it up and I've got to rub myself, rub the truth into the world. I've got to engage. I've got to be willing to get messy. I've got to be willing to, you know, to get some germs on me. And, you know, and that's the whole point that of being the salt. It's not easy. It's messy. It's something that, you know, that's involved. And so we can't just say, well, I want to be salt. I want to be safe. You know, listen, if we want to be salt of the earth, then we have to engage. To take being salt seriously, it means that we go into the world. It means that we build relationships with people. It means that we rub ourselves in the lives. That means people who are a mess. That means people that their lives are broken. People who have not experienced the preservative power of the gospel, people who don't use language that we like, or that our kids, you know, are misbehaving, or kids are, you know, out of order, and all these things. You know, we may not be comfortable with that. That may not be where we choose, but you know what? We cannot be salt without engaging and rubbing into the world. We've got to build relationships. That's part of what we talk about, this praying for three people, and realize that every one of us have people in our lives that we have a chance to reach. Now, some of them may be people that we would choose not to spend time with because it's messy. But you know what? You cannot be salt without getting messy. You cannot be salt without rubbing into people's lives, getting close to them. That's messy. It exposes our lives to the decay. It's a whole lot more pleasant to retreat into the sterile environment of, you know, safe and just my church friends and just my Bible study and you know, not to interact with non-believers. It's tempting for us to make all of our friendships with people that have things in common that aren't going to ever offend us. But, you know, God has called us to be salt. And we live in a world that is decaying, and the only hope for that world is for Christians to live out their lives in a way that is rubbing in. Salt is never going to be effective until it's rubbed into that which it hopes to preserve. That's just a basic truth of nature. It cannot be sprinkled from a distance because it's never going to be absorbed. It's never going to be fully absorbed into the meat that it hopes to preserve. And you know what I love is that you do have so many people that are doing this. You know, there's so many times, I know that so many of you are praying for people. So many, I talk to people, oh, I'm trying to get together with this unbelieving friend. I know people that are here, and you're here because people have invited you, because they built a relationship and they want to share. You know, people are reaching out through ministries, through sports ministry, through, you know, through inviting through our pay setters and senior citizens. And what happens is that we're rubbing in, and we need to be patient. We need to recognize as we reach out to someone, sometimes they're going to reject us. Sometimes you share the gospel. I want nothing to do with you. They're going to reject us. But be patient and recognize that a lot of times the effect of this isn't going to be instantaneously. See, the thing about being salt is it's something that is more about perseverance. It's not about being visible. It's not the big event. It's not the one time that I shared my faith. It's about perseverance, of rubbing into people's lives, of building relationships. not doing extraordinary things, but just everyday life. And so the question of application I want to ask you is this: whose life are you intentionally rubbing yourself into? See, if we think about it, all of us have people that we could, but many of us choose not to because it's messy. Are you willing to be salt? And if you're going to be salt, whose life are you intentionally rubbing yourself into? And are you willing to start if you're not? Are you willing to pray that God would give you opportunities? Well, God calls us to be salt. He also calls us to be light. Look at verse 14. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand. And it gives light to all those in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Now, when's the last time that you were in complete darkness? If you all think about a time that, you know, you wake up, if there's no lights and you're in complete darkness, you're tripping over things, especially if you're in darkness in a place that is a little unfamiliar. And it's disconcerting. It can be dangerous. You know, we don't like it. Now, I want you to notice what Jesus says here. It says that you are the light of the world. It's not that you should be or you need to become the light. It says that if you are a follower of Christ, you are. We are the light of the world by the presence, by the virtue of his presence within us. See, it's not a question of whether we will be the light or not. It's only a question of what is the quality of our light. We live in a world that is dark, that is lost, and the only hope is the light of Jesus Christ. And the only light that people will see is the light that is lived out and expressed by the followers of Jesus Christ, being faithful and living that out. So what will we be? See, and the fact is that the world will make judgment calls about Jesus, about the truth of the gospel, about its power to change lives based on what it sees. So even if you don't want to be the light, even if you don't want to be noticed, if anybody knows that you're a follower of Christ in any way, they're going to say, well, the quality of who Jesus Christ is I'm going to interpret that by what I see in your life. See, the other thing that's interesting about this as well is that when you look at this where he says, you know, you are the light of the world, Jesus elsewhere said that I am the light of the world. He didn't ever say I'm the salt. He does say that I am the light. And so when you look at this, you say, well, how can Jesus be the light in that we are the light? Well, here's the whole idea. It's when we understand that he is the light, it's almost in some ways like he's the sun, we're the moon, we reflect. Or better yet, when you think of in his day, the lights that they used were oil lamps. And the light is the flame. He's the flame. We're the lamp. We're the ones that hold the flame. And so the question is, are we holding the flame? And if we're holding it out, then others can see him. He is the light. It's him shining in and through us. And if you're a Christian, then you have the Holy Spirit in you. And as a result, you are the light. That's who God created us to be. Again, the issue is not whether we are the light. The issue is, what is the quality? Are we hiding our light? Do we have the courage to hold our light high, to live it without, you know, to live it out without compromise? Or are we hiding it? Are we ashamed? Are we living a light, a quality of a light that is defined by compromise? Now, again, here you've got to remember, too, what is the purpose of light? The purpose of salt is to preserve. The purpose of light is to illuminate, is to make something visible. And so when it says this, it's saying what? You know, that as Christians, it's not just a matter of, okay, are you a Christian or are you trying to live things out? Being visible means being willing to talk about it, being unashamed when we're asked. And when there's opportunity to be able to share the reason of our faith, to be visible. So the question is here again, we are the light. That's not a question. The question, what is the quality of our light? What quality will we be? And even in this, let me try to illustrate this a little bit more. You see, I think that deep down, many of us, when we think what kind of light will we want to be, I think we kind of like to be kind of like Christmas lights. You know, I've got some Christmas lights here, and we all kind of like, you know, these aren't all stringed out here, but isn't that nice? I mean, even when I was coming here, yesterday, I was pulling some of these out. My one daughter, she said, Christmas lights. I love Christmas lights. Everybody loves Christmas lights. You know, twinkle lights, they're nice and warm and comfortable. And we like to say, well, I'd like to be Christmas lights, right? And I think many of us, that's what we think. I want to be that. Now, the thing is, when we think about Christmas lights, they are nice and warm. They're nice and comforting. As Christians, we want to be warm. We want to be loving. We want people to know that they're loved. And we want to be comforted. And we want to We want people to say, oh, aren't they nice? We want to be loved too. Now, are Christmas lights good? Yeah. Now, why do you have Christmas lights? Primarily, they're decoration. Now, what is the purpose of the light of the world? The world needs light, but what does the world need? Decoration? No, illumination. I mean, if you're lost in the middle of the woods and you say, man, I've got to find my way out, do you go find Christmas lights to help you find your way out? No. I mean, if you're lost something really valuable in the middle of a dark field, you don't go find the Christmas lights to help you find it. You know, you find the biggest flashlight you can. If you can get a plug, you know, you say, let me go get the giant. Okay, I've got the spotlight. Yeah, people are, now this is, you know, if I'm lost, I can go over here. Man, I can find anything. Now this is, if the purpose is illumination, there's a big difference between that and this, isn't there? Now what is Jesus calling us to? We might be comfortable with being the little twinkly lights, and man, I really like being twinkly lights, but what we need to realize is that when he says that you are the light of the world, we've got to realize that God has called us to be light in the sense not of being warm and making people feel good, but our world is in darkness and lost, and it needs illumination. When our goal is to be that, not this. That's what we're called to be. Now, somebody might say, well, wait a second. You know, we look at that and you say, well, the first difference is that, you know, our quality is determined by our capacity. And so we're called to be light that illuminates, not just nice little lights that, you know, that are. But somebody might say, but all that I am is this. You know, this is, it's great to say that, but I think that this is all that I have to offer. Now, let me remind you something. When we said that we are the light, remember, we aren't the light, we hold the light. What is the light? Christ in us. All of us have Christ in us. And you know what? That's what we have. We are that. That's what we are. So why is it that so many of us are this? Well, if you look here, you know, you see these little, they're not only tiny lights, but they have little tiny, you know, things that are, you know, electrical things that light them. They don't need much electricity. You know, this one, we've got this, you know, big old honking, you know, extension cord that we need to plug in because it's pulling power. But here's the amazing thing, is that both of these are plugged into the same source. Now, when we realize that, what we realize is that we're all plugged in the same source. We're plugged into the Holy Spirit. We have the Holy Spirit. We have Christ in us, and he wants to shine, and he calls us to be the light of the world. Now, the question is, are we just letting a little tiny bit seep through so that we're just a little twinkly lights? Are we letting all of him come through so that we say, God, I want you to shine through me so that, yes, I'll be illumination. But you know what? As we look at this, do you always like the big light? Sometimes it shines and people are like, oh, don't shine on me. And sometimes it's uncomfortable. These are a whole lot warmer. See, now the second quality is defined by our connection. But here's the challenge when you look at this. Christmas lights are a whole lot more comfortable, aren't they? And there's a challenge of living as light in a dark culture. And I think this challenge is summed up best in John chapter 3. Look what we have in John 3. It starts off, we all know, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son. Whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe is condemned already because he has not believed. Because he's not believed in the name of the only Son of God. And this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and the people love the darkness rather than the light because the works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come into the light, lest his works should be exposed. Now here's the idea. You know, why is it that people, whoever loves wicked things, hate the light? Why? Because they're afraid of being exposed. Now what are they afraid of being exposed in? You know, you look at that and you say, well, they know what they're doing. They're, you know, they, especially in our day, they openly live it. They proclaim it. They celebrate it. So why are they afraid of being exposed? The fact is that deep down, I believe that on most issues of sin, people deep down know that they're wrong. People deep down, we've been given a conscience by God, and deep down we know that there's some external standard that we're breaking that standard. We know that. And that's why people act with anger and even hatred when anybody talks about biblical truth. You know, you think about it, you have people that live out the life and they never, you know, all they do is they live out their life. A great example, Tim Tebow, you know, really controversial person. And people will talk about him and saying, well, he's a bigot and he's judgmental and he's all these things. Have you ever heard Tim Tebow say anything that's judgmental or bigoted? No. I mean, he lives out his life and he lives, he talks about Christ and he talks about, following Christ and loving people, but people hate him. You know why? It's because people see his life and they see him talking about commitment to sexual purity as an example. And without him saying, well, people that don't are wrong, they deep down know. And so they hate him. And that's why we see, and if you go back to John 3:17, what does it say? God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned. Whoever does not believe is condemned already. That's why he's saying this idea that we know that we're already condemned. There's something that we know there's a guilt. And our goal isn't to pound guilt. It's to say, you know that you're guilty before God. Here's a hope. That's why, you think about it. You have people that believe other faiths. And they talk about their moral standards, and I'm not offended by that. I get a Hindu that says, I believe in reincarnation, so we can't eat cows because that might be my great aunt that's being reincarnated. And I'm not offended. I'll say, let's go get a hamburger. Let's talk about it. It's not a big deal. And you could believe whatever you want because I know that's wrong. I know it's foolishness. And so why is it that when we talk about biblical morality, people are so offended? They're offended by that more than any other religion because they know it's right. And so what we're called to do is that we're called to live out our faith in a way that's not about condemning, but that's not about compromising. About a man who goes out and is unwilling to compromise and cheat at work like everyone else and false reports, or is unwilling to go out to the strip clubs afterwards and hang out with people because he says, I don't want to do that. That's not my faith. Or, I talked to somebody recently, a young woman who wears a purity ring at school, and she gets teased because of that. And you have people that tease her and will attack her because her light exposes darkness. And what we need to do is to live out our faith. And when somebody calls us, to be unashamed of explaining. And you have people that will say, well, what about, isn't that condemning? And why we should just be Christmas lights. We should be warm and be loving. But you know what? If we're doing that, what we're doing is we're keeping people from being exposed. And if they're never going to shine the truth, they will never see the error and they will never find Jesus Christ. See, I don't say that because I'm morally superior or because I know the way or people. No, we say this because this is the truth. And we live in a world that, as much as it hates the truth, desperately needs it. And unless we proclaim it without compromise, it will be secure in us being lost. It will be happy, but it will never find truth. And it will never find hope. It will never find the light of the hope of the gospel. And so the closing question that I'm gonna ask you here is this. How bright is your light? Are you living out that light? What is the quality of your light? If someone were to look to you for direction, they're lost and they're looking to your lifestyle for direction to try to figure out how to live life. Would the light of your life help them find the truth? Would it lead them towards Christ? Are you willing to live as salt of the earth, to rub into people's lives? Are you willing to live as light of the earth? Without compromise, without compromise in who we are and what we say, because we live in a world that desperately needs salt and light. It's the only hope for our culture.